Welcome to the Performance Hub. I'm your host, Ann Guzman. When you drop in to listen here, you can expect to hear valuable conversations with interesting people about sports nutrition, human physiology, mindset, and navigating change in life. My goal with these conversations is that you leave with practical tools that can help you maximize your performance and mindset for both life and sport. I hope these conversations resonate with you on some level, inspire you, and even challenge your perspectives on particular topics. I, for one, am a super curious person, and I'm looking forward to learning from my guests and asking some burning questions. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to sharing these conversations with you, and I'll see you inside the Performance Hub. All right, today I'm excited to have Dr. Alwyn Wong on the show. Alwyn is a chiropractic doctor and medical acupuncturist, and he also specializes in active release techniques. He's been practicing for 20 years, so there's no shortage of expertise here on the line today. Alwyn has traveled the world working with professional athletes, and he also works with athletes of all levels, as well as the general active population, running his clinic out of Toronto here in Canada. He's also the founder of Zona Health and Performance, and that's a company dedicated to educating fitness professionals. He's the author of the book, The Kick Acid Diet, and he walks the talk, keeping himself active and fit for as long as I've known him, which we've known each other for a long time.
25 years now?
25 years, I know, pretty incredible. Alwyn, you're really passionate about injury prevention and recovery, which I'm excited to dive into conversation about today. So welcome, and I'm really grateful to have you here.
Well, thanks again for having me on, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And since I know you walk the talk and you keep in great shape, I'm actually a little curious to start off to know what you've been doing since COVID-19 and the whole pandemic started to keep as active as you are, because I know the health clubs have shut down and you're really big into weight training. So how have you been able to keep up there, or has that changed a little bit for you?
It definitely has changed. I think for me, like it has for a lot of people. The first couple of weeks were tough. Just getting out of a routine. We got hit with this virus and this new way of life. So I was just doing a lot of body weight stuff. I have some weights at home, some dumbbells. I was running. I enjoy it. I'm not a good runner by any means. Yeah. So I did that for the first couple of weeks. And then confession, I am being in the industry, I have a lot of friends that own gyms or have access to stuff. So I've been training. I've gotten back into a routine, kind of a 50% routine, as I'll call it, for the last couple of months. So I've been lucky. Yeah. So I'm kind of back, or just kind of focusing more on the compound lifts, like squats, deadlifts, some of the big stuff. I have access to everything, but I think with what's going on and kind of, you know, pivoting with everything else, I'm working out, but I'm working out at a different capacity, A, just intensity wise, but also B, I can't go in and do a workout with 10 different exercises. Not that I would, yeah. But just a headspace. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna focus on what I'm good at doing. I'm gonna do this to maintain what I already have without really trying to push the pace too much. And ironically, it's gone back to the heavy lifts. Okay. Again, like deadlifts, squats. I'm not a big bencher, but I've been benching, you know, backward chin-ups, rows. Still running as well. And doing it 4 days, you know, 3 to 4 days a week. Nice. When I have more time. I have more time to get to the gym, but I just haven't been going as often. I think just trying to manage stress, just being in a different routine.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I've been lucky. I've been just maintaining kind of, you know what? I think like everybody who has access to what we have access to, we kind of fall back to our foundation. We fall back to what we're good at. Mm-hmm. So friends of mine that are good runners have been running more. And I think just it takes less headspace to do what we're used to doing. So.
Oh, for sure.
It's been nice.
That's good. I'm glad. I'm glad, but not surprised that you found a way to keep in shape. Like, I just picture that you'd somehow find like trees to do your chin-ups off.
I have some trees in my backyard, and I had some Olympic rings. So I was doing that. Like, I was getting antsy, but I'm not going to lie. The first couple of weeks not training as hard was kind of nice. Mm-hmm. I think we all need that break, the mental break. So, you know, I was telling myself like I wanted to get back and do it, but truthfully, I think I was actually just taking some time off.
Yeah.
Just more and more mentally, I think, than physically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone was just lives thrown up in the air for a couple of weeks there, trying to figure out how to manage the, I don't want to say new normal, but just the situation. I wanted to pivot a little bit just to start off. I know you and I have had some really interesting conversations, as we often do, about, well, since I come from the world of cycling, just about how a lot of cyclists and runners or triathletes, like athletes doing those more linear type sports, those who do have more time, and I realize that's definitely not everyone's situation right now because a lot of people have a lot less time, and we'll talk about that as well when we maybe dive into stress a bit more. But when we think about the athletes that have more time and now they're doing that type of sport, they're running more, they're cycling more, and that's so linear, I really wanted to get your thoughts on what value you think cross-training brings to those athletes as far as maybe working the posterior chain or just working other muscles than the ones they're constantly pounding day after day. And are there any particular movements that you think those types of athletes should just be incorporating into their routine regularly that are accessible to most people?
Well, I guess I'm going to make an assumption that you're asking that from an injury prevention perspective rather than a performance perspective. Or are you asking both?
No, you're right. I'm asking from an injury prevention.
Okay, because I wanted to qualify that because from a performance perspective, I just put it back to you and say, well, listen, what muscles are required to generate that force to ride that bike or to run? You obviously want to get those stronger, and it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple in theory. How you execute is different. From an injury perspective, what we tend to see is for a linear athlete, especially an endurance athlete, oftentimes those muscles are overused, the prime movers. So we don't want to necessarily fatigue those muscles more. So in order to prevent injury, I would train the muscles that aren't being engaged. Or the muscles that are required to hold certain positions. So internal rotators of the hip, lower back stabilizers, even upper back and neck stabilizers. So which muscles are not being used, and then which muscles are going to hold the joint in the proper position while the athlete is moving are the muscles that I would train. So I would take kind of a two-pronged approach. One, A, train the posterior chain. So you're on a bike and you're hunched over, you're in hip flexion, you're protracted, whatever you can do to open that up. So I like deadlifts for that movement or for that purpose because they're a simple movement. It's a simple movement to perform, really. Like, okay, keep your back in neutral, make sure your feet are evenly distributed, you're driving through feet and the hips, and pull the shoulders back, get a good grip on the bar, and you're kind of good to go. I mean, most athletes are good athletes, so they can pick up movements, but there's a bit of a learning curve. So we could then take that up and say, okay, well, do a kettlebell swing. That takes a bit more skill in order to do that. Or, you know, the best movement could be like an overhead squat or an Olympic clean. But at what cost? Like, how long is it going to take the athlete to learn that movement? And you know, and the risk factor for further injuries. So if I had to pick one exercise to combat the effects of cycling and or running, I would say deadlifting. And people would probably think I would say squats. Squats are good, but if I had to pick one, it would be deadlifts. And then you can vary the intensity, the load, the volume parameters as to, you know, what type of adaptation you're trying to achieve. So that'd be the first one. And the second one, I would focus on all, if not most, but if not all the muscles that lay close to joints. And those muscles are the muscles that are the stabilizing muscles. They're the muscles that cause rotation, but also prevent rotation of the joint. So all the deep external hip rotators, the muscles of the feet, like the tibialis posterior, it seems like a bit of an odd muscle to work.
Yeah.
But how do we keep the feet, especially with runners, how do we keep the feet stable? And there's a ton of muscles that are going to be involved in that. Scapular stabilizers. So you're running or you're cycling, you're hunched forward. But how do you pull those shoulders back in a way that stabilizes them? And then as a logical extension, the rotator cuff. So you're not using the rotator cuff directly to run and to ride, but they're going to help maintain a certain position to prevent, again, this is injury prevention, recovery, not necessarily performance. So
yeah.
I find with a lot of the athletes that I'll work with, or a lot of the coaches I'll work with, not the coaches, you guys know what you're doing, but the athletes sometimes have a hard time understanding why we're prescribing certain exercises, because they don't contribute to the movement directly. It's going to allow you to stay injury free. It's going to allow you to perform that sport for a longer period of time at a greater intensity.
That's such a really great point you just made, that, you know, sometimes the athlete's like, what? I don't want to take the time away from getting in more miles to go to the gym, because it's, you know, it's not going to make me, you know, faster necessarily. And I mean, you know, everyone's going to have their own situation, but yeah, I completely agree with the, you know, the deadlifting. I always deadlifted when I was cycling. And even as you were saying it, as you're saying deadlifting, rotator cuffs, I caught myself like sitting up straighter.
Yeah.
Shoulders back, right? Because I am hunched over a lot. But everything you're saying is also, it's just so functional. Like it's healthy, right? You don't want to, you just become so, like, would you say you become weak in the posterior chain from being, let's say if you're on a bike and you're stretched out, like, are those muscles getting weaker?
For sure. I mean, we go really technical that weaker, but also, you know, we develop a normal length of the muscle. So we're on that bike for hours, or you're on that bike for hours. You're in a thoracic, you know, your spine is flexed. Your body learns how to be in that position.
Yeah.
Because you need to be in that position to ride. You may not necessarily want to be upright while you're riding, but, you know, you get off the bike, then that's going to pose problems.
Right.
And it's going to cause, not only pose problems just posture and aesthetically, but it's going to put certain stresses on joints that, while you may need to be in that position while you're competing, you don't want to be in that position all day.
Right.
It's going to cause, you know, damage to the discs. It's going to cause damage, or just pain to some of the ligaments and whatnot. I remember being at a talk. It was a guy who was lecturing on anatomy and fascia, and he made some comment of the best way to lengthen our fascia and keep it healthy is to drink water. And the whole, everyone in the crowd kind of put their coffee down and pick up their water bottle. So it's that we know it, but sometimes we've seen someone else say it to us.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned the overhead, like, squat. I mean, that, like, I know myself, like, as far as my mobility, I'm not going to lie, that I'm quite sure I can't do a great overhead squat. So are there movements like that that most people should be capable of doing that indicate some type of general mobility and function?
Oh, the million-dollar question. This might be the most controversial thing I'll say in this podcast, is I'm not a huge fan of the functional movement screens and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because one of the tests is an overhead squat, and there's such a skill component to that, that if you've never practiced it, you're probably not going to be good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But does that make you at any risk? Does that increase your risk of injury? The theory says that it does, but you may never put yourself in that position. So to answer your question, from a health perspective, yeah, we should be able to do certain things. I wouldn't say in an ideal world, we should be able to overhead squat with a lightweight, all the way up, all the way down. But is that, do we have to be able to chase after that in order to be able to perform the way we want to? I'm going to say, this is just opinion. I'm going to say no, because going back to your athletes wanting to do so, that's going to improve their performance. What cost is there in order to be able to perform that overhead squat? It's taking away from the time on the bike.
Yeah.
So to that question, I would say, okay, here's my answer to that. We should be able to move every joint individually through its full range of motion pain-free. Step one.
Right.
But now when we combine joint movements, it's not that simple, because then there's a neurological component, there's a balance component. I stretch my hamstrings out, which is going to pull my lower back, which is going to prevent my lats from opening up. That's just normal anatomy. So I would say people should be able to perform. They should move their joints individually through their full range of motion individually. And then your functional capacity in a bike is going to be different than mine. My functional capacity in the weight room is going to be different than yours. So I should be able to squat, rock, you know, ass to grass, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
But an Olympic level cyclist may not be able to do that. But that doesn't mean I'm a better cyclist than they are, or I'm less likely to get injured on the bike.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the specificity of training, right? It is important. Yeah. And like you said, you know, you have to think about the time and what's worth the investment in time. And so definitely that makes a lot of sense. When you're dealing with clients who are injured, like I know I've had my share and we've discussed like the difference between doing physiotherapy and exercises versus some of the techniques you might use, like activation of muscles through acupuncture or other methods that maybe you can share you do in the clinic. But can you talk a little bit about like the different types of approaches to recovery from injury and when one may be more appropriate than the other? So when the physio exercises may be more appropriate versus getting in there and doing the acupuncture if you have this chronic injury that doesn't seem to be progressing?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. And I'm going to look at this through, you know, kind of through my lens. You know, I'll try to be as unbiased as possible, because there's a lot of different tools in that proverbial toolbox that we can use. But I tend to look at it, and I think I'm pretty accurate. Hopefully, I'm accurate in thinking of it this way. Is looking at, you know, taking a broader approach. Like I've looked at some of my mentors, and I thought, okay, well, what they've done or how they've approached things have been really simple. But it took me years of experience to realize the beauty in their approach. And then the first step is this, is are we in the side of dysfunction or function? If we're on the side of dysfunction, which I tend to operate on because of what I do, my job is to get my patient on the side of function in the shortest amount of time as effectively as possible.
Yeah.
And then from there, then I'm technically, you know, no pun intended, I'm hands off.
Yeah.
So normal function is the ability to contract a muscle through full range of motion. That's kind of it. But then that normal function has a huge range, because maybe you're not strong enough. I'm not, that's not my job anyway. You know, go work out. Maybe there's not enough cardiovascular capacity. Go work out. Maybe you're carrying too much excess body fat. Talk to your nutrition, lose that fat. That's not my job. My job is to say, okay, well, is that muscle capable of contracting properly from a performance perspective? Mm-hmm. Is there inflammation? I'm going to get rid of that inflammation. Is there alteration in the neuromuscular junction function, whether it's nerve firing, whether it's responsiveness of the muscle? Is there too much scar tissue? Is there pain? That's what I want. I want to address that, get that person working normally so they can do stuff on their own or with their coach or with their trainer. Whether they do it or not, that's kind of on them. So to your point is, what am I looking? So that's kind of the broad stroke, function versus dysfunction.
Okay.
So what I've kind of learned recently, I think as I've gotten older and appreciating my own body and the body of, that I'm seeing, because our client base, our patient base kind of grows with us.
Yeah.
Is someone comes in and I do active release. So I'm going to break up any scar tissue due to prolonged inflammation and whatnot, and release tissue adhesion. That's kind of step number one for me, is looking at the health of the soft tissues. Now I use active release, but there's lots of other soft tissue techniques that can work. Mm-hmm. So again, to make this non-dogmatic, whatever technique you're going to use to improve the health of the tissue kind of needs to be done. Step two is, how do we improve? Okay, so here's an example. I had a calcific tendonitis of my rectus femoris. This is a personal account. Active release wasn't working. I went and I went to see a physio friend of mine, and she did shockwave therapy. Okay. I don't do that. That worked better than anything else. So that was another soft tissue technique. Mm-hmm. So just getting the soft tissues healthy. I see an osteopath often as well. She's a chiro slash osteopath. So her technique has been different than mine. It's much more gentle, but it works at times when active release doesn't work. She'll often refer patients to me for active release. We just figure out what's going on with the tissue. Second one is the nerve function. I use acupuncture and electroacupuncture to stimulate nerve, to alter the sensory input and the motor output of a nerve. I find it's very effective. I can be very specific with it. Some people will use TENS or IFC to affect the nerve. Certain adjustments can alter, spinal adjustments can alter the sensory input to a nerve and also the motor output. So, if you go back to chiropractic 101 or just joint manipulations that are done by physios, osteopaths, that can also affect the nerve input. So if my neurological system isn't functioning properly, it could be due to peripheral nerve compression. So I do active release, that helps. Well, what if I do active release and it doesn't help? Then maybe I turn to acupuncture. Do that, great. Then let's say that doesn't help it. Well, maybe there's an inflammatory inhibition at the maybe the joint's not moving properly, so I adjust the joint, and then the nerves work. Well, what if it's chronic inflammation that's inhibiting the nerve? Then I have to look at that. So we look at the dysfunction, but then we have to look at what the cause of the dysfunction is. So that's a kind of our job: reduce that dysfunction.
Yeah.
And get people back to function. And the last little part of that is, and this is going back to what I said about, learning a bit more, is maybe the body isn't in a state that's where it's capable of responding to nutrition, training, or treatment. And maybe it's more of a, like I said, even an even broader stroke, that maybe that person needs to sleep better. Maybe that person has an accumulation of X, Y, or Z in their body. Maybe that person just isn't recovering, or they're undergoing too much stress. And there's nothing, I can modulate that a little bit with acupuncture, but that's just a lifestyle thing. That's just life. Maybe they're not ready to recover.
Yeah.
They have three kids and they're going through lockdown and COVID and all this stuff. So I have to also understand that what needs to be done, but also understand the limitation of my scope in their healing process.
No, that's a brilliant point. I mean, every situation is so independent, and I know we're going to get to speaking about this more. I just have a question first, but yes, stress. I mean, stress is such a huge factor on your physiology. Before we jump to that, I want to come back for a second to the acupuncture, because I'm not really sure, and I'm definitely not an expert. Obviously, that's not my field. Can you kind of explain a little bit what's happening when you get acupuncture? So you're talking about, improving nerve conduction. What does that really mean as far as an athlete listening, thinking, oh, I'm going to get acupuncture? A lot of people just lie there, get the needles, and they leave. But it'd be great to understand what's happening.
Yeah, so acupuncture, and if any of my colleagues or some of the people that I teach, so I teach an anatomy course at an acupuncture school. Okay. And it's a traditional acupuncture school, a traditional Chinese medicine, which is brilliant. They're just brilliant. It's a system that's been around for thousands of years, and I'm not going to profess to know all the intricacies of the traditional acupuncture. Mm-hmm. But it will qualify that thing. It does work. It clearly is efficacious. The acupuncture that I learned was a neuroanatomical approach to acupuncture. And When I teach the anatomy component of it, and one of the things I'll say from an acupuncture perspective to answer your question, and it absolves us of any liability from guaranteeing results. So if someone were to put an acupuncture needle in, or if you look at it from a dry needle, so whether it's in an acupuncture spot or point versus a non-acupuncture point, you take the stainless steel needle, you insert it into the body, there's only two things we guarantee that can happen. One is, because it's invasive, it causes the cells around the needles to degranulate. What that means is it causes the cells to partially break apart and to release chemicals into the surrounding area. Mm-hmm. And those chemicals are going to do one of two things. They're either going to stimulate a nerve or inhibit a nerve. The other thing that acupuncture does, it's pressure. You're putting a needle in it, it's stimulating proprioceptors or nerve receptors. That's all we know.
Mm-hmm. From a factual perspective.
Okay.
And then from a cause and effect, there's a myriad of hundreds, thousands of different things that we've observed. So you put needle in point A, it blocks pain because of this. Oh, that's kind of neat. We didn't expect that, but it does that. That gets repeated over thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of patients, where then we can confidently say, from a clinical perspective, if I put a needle in stomach 36, it's going to block pain because it affects these other structures upstream and downstream. So that becomes a clinical approach to acupuncture. But to answer your question specifically, acupuncture works like the rest of the body works by forcing the body, by the rest of the any other stimulus. So that's a better way of looking at it. It forces the body to adapt, bottom line. And it does so by taking the pressure from the needle or the invasiveness of the needle and converting it to an electrical signal. Again, that's what every other modality does. That's our body, that's how our nervous system communicates.
Okay.
Through electrical signals. So by inserting a needle, we can just improve the electrical conductivity of the sensory nerve input, which is needed, you know, blocks pain, it changes how your body perceives things. But what's really fascinating from an athletic perspective is how we change the conductivity the other way from a motor output. Can we increase the speed of nerve conduction to a muscle?
Okay.
Can we then change the amount of neurotransmitters between the nerve and the neuromuscular junction? And then can we change how that muscle responds to the neuromuscular junction? It's brilliant when, like, there's more and more research coming out. And yeah, so that's one of the ways I like to use acupuncture from a performance perspective. And that kind of blurs the line between function and dysfunction. And that's where it becomes clinical and a bit subjective. So my bias into the thing, you're going to go train, you're going to do all your work outside of the clinic, but what can we do in the treatment on the table to improve your ability of that nerve to communicate with that muscle?
And when you the acupuncture can increase the nerve-to-nerve conduction and, you know, the firing, was it rate of the muscle?
So it fires the rate. Okay, so we look at a refractory rate of the muscle. Muscles and nerves tend to function in an all or none manner.
So what does that mean, refractory rate?
Oh, sorry. So refractory period. So if we stimulate a nerve to fire, it's time. It's milliseconds. There's a finite amount of time where that nerve can't fire again. Same thing with a muscle. So, a muscle fiber. So, you know, if I fire one muscle fiber in my bicep, it's not going to be very strong. I have to fire hundreds or thousands of them, or I have to fire them over and over again. So if I can take that refractory period and shorten it so it allows the muscle fiber to recover and fire quicker again, then we get a summation. We get an additive effect of the contraction.
Awesome.
That's brilliant. So by using electroacupuncture, we can change the frequency of which we stimulate a nerve and stimulate a muscle. So the same thing happens in nerves. If we send a signal to propagate along a nerve, that nerve has to fire then relax. If we can shorten the relaxation time, we get a faster nerve. We get a more responsive nerve because the neurons fire. You know, I'm gonna totally oversimplify this.
Yeah.
Fire faster.
Okay. And so can you regenerate the function of a nerve then through acupuncture?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what's interesting? It's talked about age. When I was studying chiropractic, it was people were kind of on the fence about whether nerves can regenerate.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's kind of common knowledge, nerves can regenerate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's structural damage to a nerve, depending on the extent of it, acupuncture is not gonna fix that. If there's minor damage, you know, it can help regenerate through a process known as trophic changes. And it comes down to the granulation and degranulation of the tissues that we talked about. But often a lot of neurological conditions they're not structural, they're functional. Which means everything to our naked eye or to our ability to assess that nerve is intact. And if that's the case, well, if there's no damage, why isn't that nerve functioning properly?
Mm-hmm.
And then we get really nuanced and details to what maybe you know, there's so many inputs to it. Like you talk about stress and then their whole recovery process. So, I'm treating someone and like, okay, you have to see me, I'm doing this stuff, but it's not working. It's not working as well as it should. So, I send someone to, their coach, their training, they're still not getting the off. Maybe we have to take a step back and say, maybe it's a psychological thing. Maybe there's something in that person's brain chemistry through stress, trauma, something outside of my scope that's inhibiting that. What is stopping that nerve? What is stopping that healthy nerve from working the way that it should?
Okay, that's really amazing. I mean, it's really helpful, right? It gives you a lot of hope if you are in that situation where there doesn't appear to be something structural that perhaps you can regain some functionality. Functionality, not sure if that's the proper word when you're talking about nerves, but it's super.
That's the exact word you want to use.
Okay.
It's functionality or function versus structure.
Yeah. Since we're on the topic of stress, I want to turn this way because I know this is something you're really passionate about. And I'm curious if you can talk to the point, how is stress impacting us physiologically and how can that manifest in the body? And what do you do with patients to help manage that stress? Because I know this is kind of an area you're really focusing on more in your practice.
Yeah, and for a million reasons. I was asked to do a talk about a month ago at a symposium on anti-aging recovery tactics and methods. And one was, as we dug into it, one of the big things is stress. Like how does stress affect us? So to kind of reiterate your question, if I'm modulating stress from a physiological perspective, acupuncture is a really, really effective way of doing it. And it's kind of neat. There's been a ton of research for decades on that. So, I'll use a couple points. It modulates stress from an upstream, then eventually a downstream perspective. Like what does a pituitary gland do? What does the hypothalamus do? Like what are we doing? How are we changing the brain's response and the brain's chemistry to stress? But what it doesn't do, what I don't do, and I always let people know that, our bodies, the stress response is a stress response. We're responding to something. So I'm not altering the stimuli because it could be a million things. It could be financial. It could be anything. So that's one of the things I think we really need to appreciate, that sometimes the best thing we can do is to just stop the stress. And that sounds simple. But that's, I can keep chasing after stopping, trying to stop it from acupuncture, from meditation, from lavender oil, whatever. But if we're not stopping the source of stress, then our bodies are still undergoing that response.
Right.
So how does stress affect our bodies? It's fascinating. I'll talk about one element. And I think it's a unifying element as to from a recovery and from an aging perspective is, one of the main chemicals or hormones of stress is cortisol. Everyone knows about cortisol. And a derivative of cortisol is it's a corticosteroid. And we use cortisone injections for healing and inflammation and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But the excessive corticosteroid use, and I'm going to use that to lump everything together, has been shown to break down tissue. And again, we all know that. So if our bodies are undergoing a short-term stress response and then it returns to normal, the stress level might be higher, but it's not prolonged enough to cause any tissue damage. And it does what it should do by reducing the effects of stress.
So just to jump in there, do you mind if I just want to clarify what you're saying? So are you saying that if you have a cortisol response, that's okay if it's acute, but once it becomes chronic, that's when it's a problem.
Exactly. And that's the underlying, again, part one of the unifying kind of factor in all this is, as we get older, two things happen. I don't like to use the word aging because we don't necessarily quote unquote age as we get older. We all age differently. And some of it's genetic, but hopefully this will clarify things that, if you have multiple stress responses, as we do, without a refractory rate, used loosely, or without a recovery period, then our bodies are undergoing a chronic stress response. So stress A, financial, okay, we overcome that. But before we overcome that, we have physical stress. Okay, we're overcoming that, then we have then it just becomes a chronic stress response. Mm-hmm. Or that's kind of one. And two, as we get older, we just accumulate stress because of life. Like we're just, you know, we're 15. What was stressing us out back then is different than what's stressing us out now. And what's stressing us out now is constant. Okay, I work every day. I have bills to pay every day, every month. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, so that kind of jumps on to step number two. So we have this chronic cortisol response, as an example, that's constantly breaking down tissues. So we're going to hold that thought for a second. That's breaking down our muscle cells, our ligaments, all this other stuff.
Can I ask you a question?
Yep.
So are you saying that if you have that chronic stress, that would be an impediment to gaining muscle, for example?
Absolutely.
That's pretty important, right? I mean, that's a big deal for, especially for people who might be listening who are training and, you know, that might be a goal that they're working towards, but yet they're kind of running uphill or into a headwind unless they change their environment where the stress is coming from.
Exactly.
Right. Sorry to interrupt. Keep on going.
No, that's a good question because I'm glad you asked that and compound that. So, you know, we're trying to put muscle on, so we go to the gym, which is exercise is a feel good. Training is a feel good exercise with the release of endorphins and whatnot. It's not a stress release. And I think that needs to be delineated because the only reason exercise feels good is because there's a stress response. The stress response causes endorphins. So we're working out, we're like, this feels great, but our bodies are physiologically under too much stress. So we're still in that headwind. So the thing that should be helping isn't helping. It's actually making it worse.
Is that if your baseline of stress is high? What if your baseline of stress is very low and now you go and exercise and generate stress and come back to a low stress level? Does that change the picture?
Yeah, you just stole my next point.
Oh, sorry.
That's it. No, that's exactly. And probably in a more practical way than I would have described it. Yeah, if we can get our stress levels back to normal, we need stress.
Right.
That's the ideal situation. Because what you just mentioned, I'm so happy that you mentioned that, was if our bodies are under a chronic stress load, it's a breakdown of tissues, and our bodies no longer have the appropriate response to stress. It's like a rebound effect. It's like pulling an arrow. If you're already pulling, you're already stressing, you can't respond. So to be able to go from, like, say, no stress, say a normal level of stress, mm-hmm. and you go work out, and you have this acute level of stress, that's actually good for our bodies. Mm-hmm. If we're starting from a point of normal, and we can come back to a point of normal.
Great.
So that's a big step. And if we go back to the tissue breakdown, those tissues that are being broken down, you know, they're being broken down, which is not a good thing, right? So we have dead and dying cells, which is, we use the word senescent, right? Senescent cells, broken down tissues. Not only do those tissues break down and do we lose mass and do we lose function, they also, two things happen. They also, when they become unfolded, they should become folded, refolded properly, but they don't. Some of them become misfolded. So now we have dysfunctional proteins in our body. And they can become deposited on various tissues, whether it's cardiovascular tissues, you know, increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease, or the big one is on the brain, right? So you have plaque formation, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. So if our cells then, let's say they don't refold normally or abnormally, because they're dying off, they're releasing pro-inflammatory cytokines or chemicals. So we have these dead and dying cells releasing and causing your body to be under a chronic state of inflammation. So we have chronic stress and chronic inflammation. That inflammation then causes further tissue breakdown, insulin resistance, muscle breakdown, pain and bloating. So if we can stop that process, we can speed our healing dramatically, and we can slow the effects of aging. So the chronic stress response breaks down these tissues, causing a whole myriad of different effects.
Yeah, it's totally fascinating, and you're making me want to go meditate right now because I'm like,
right?
So having said all that, which is completely fascinating and hopefully, you know, putting some alarm bells on for anyone that's listening on how important the environment is on, you know, if you can change the environment, then you can impact the stress and all these physiological repercussions. What are some practical things that you're recommending or working with clients through in order to manage stress, like manage the environment so that you're not just constantly putting out fires?
Right. Well, okay. So I know you and I were messaging this morning about that. We were talking about some free and accessible techniques.
Mm-hmm.
This has been the most fascinating part about like going on this recovery and anti-aging journey is it's so simple, but there's tons of research backing it and the science makes sense. Okay, so the big one is, you know, you talk about changing the environment. And that's the first one I'll always qualify, but I'll doubly qualify. So if you had to change your environment, I said, but two things. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychotherapist. So that's not my realm, that's not my expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Nor am I you. Like, I'm not living your life. Like, some of these stressors are inevitable. And, you know, we always have these, it's, you know, it's funny. Everyone's offering unsolicited advice. But you never know, you know, you don't walk in someone else's shoes. And I think that's important, that what might be a stressor for you may not be a stressor for me and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to kind of give, you know, as, you know, and, you know, to put ourselves in the quote unquote positions of authority, it's almost giving people permission to have those stressors. Okay, yeah, you have them. There's no judgment, of course, and they're valid and legitimate, and they're a reason why you're not recovering. And I think we just have to say that's just the way it is. That's just physiology. So I would say, you know, talk to whoever you need to talk to, you know, figure that out. And then I'll qualify by saying, you know, I'm dealing with my own stuff. So it's not that I'm any better than you. It's just, this is the situation that we're in. So that's the first one. The second one is going back, you know, I guess to more your pointed question is, okay, so what can we do? How do we reduce stress? Breathing. Like, it's so cool. They call it resonant frequency breathing. Breathing at a certain cadence per minute has been shown to reduce the fight or flight and reduce the rest and digest or the parasympathetic state. And that's anywhere from 5.5 to 6 breaths per minute, which is not that easy.
Can you just explain for anyone listening who doesn't understand the parasympathetic system?
So the parasympathetic system is your your autonomic nervous system, which I love calling the automatic nervous system. It controls all your body's automatic functions, right? So your sympathetic, your fight or flight is when you're under a stress response. You know, your muscles contract, you get increased blood flow to the muscles. You have a big cortisol dump. You have an increase in blood sugar levels, but your muscles need the fuel. But then at the same time, all your restorative functions go down. That's your parasympathetic or your rest and digest. So in a state of recovery, your digestion improves, your urinary system improves, your heart rate lowers, brain waves change because your body's trying to recover. We tend to live in a state of fight or flight, and we tend not to live in a state of rest and digest or parasympathetic. So that's what that is. And by breathing properly, and right, it's something I love. A lot of this stuff is the stuff that we can do, that we do anyways. You have to breathe.
Yeah.
You have to breathe. Okay, well, what are the things we have to do? You have to sleep, but you can kind of put sleep off. You have to eat. Well, you can go 3 days without eating. You have to drink water. Oh, no, you can go 3 days without water. These are things you should do, of course. But from a priority, you have to breathe. You have to breathe.
Right.
So if there's something we can do, let's just improve our ability to breathe so we can get into that rest and digest state. And right there, if you can do that, that breaks the stress response.
So tell us how to breathe.
Okay, so easier said than done. Breathing at six breaths a minute. that simple as that. Slowing down your breath. We normally breathe from 12 to 20 breaths per minute. If you can take that down to 6 breaths per minute, technically 5.5 is ideal, but that's hard to measure. So you grab a metronome, you just time it. So breathe in, takes you 30 seconds. Sorry, takes you 5 seconds. Breathe out, another 5 seconds. That's one breath.
So does it matter if you breathe in through your nose versus your mouth?
Well, anatomically, you know, that's the one job for our nose, that, you know, breathing and smelling. So I've always encouraged people to breathe in through their nose rather than through their mouth. And I know this doesn't happen very often, but breathing in through your mouth, there's more than one passageway for that ear to go where it should be going. Whereas when you breathe through your nose, it's a simpler way of getting the ear to where you want it to be. What's really interesting, and you and I were talking about this earlier, and you sent me that link about how breathing through your nose results in increased parasympathetic nervous activity. So there, again, I haven't done much reading on that, and I will, but it appears that breathing through your nose kind of confers a benefit to, you know, autonomic nervous system regulation. So I would encourage breathing through your nose at 6 beats per minute to get you out of that sympathetic state and back into that parasympathetic state.
Great. And so, you know, if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, oh gosh, you know, I have to do this and I have to do that, you know, I'm never looking for the magic bullet, but this seems right. Like, would I be right to say that this seems like something you could just do for a minute or two and there could even be impact that quickly?
I'm going to say yes. And I'm saying yes without quotations, because the studies that they've done have been for 15 minutes. But that's not to say that a minute's not going to help either. Like, you know what I mean? It's not to say, okay, 15 minutes is optimal, but it's not black or white saying it has to be 15 minutes.
Right.
So I think, you know, if you were to do it for a minute, people are busy, they have other things on their mind. Not to mention, if you're used to breathing in at 12 to 20 beats per minute, to slow that down, it's a bit of a skill, right? So to do for 1 minute is a good start, but also it might just feel good that you want to do it for longer, but you have to start somewhere.
Right. And so breathing is one of the practical things that you recommend to clients. Is there anything else you recommend that is, you know, easy to achieve without, you know, completely changing lifestyles?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. There are some other ones, but breathing is accessible to us. We have to breathe. So I always start with that. That's a simple one. So go back to your last question about, you know, if you can only do it for a minute. Yes. And I say this as if I'm talking to myself. If I can't carve out 15 minutes of my day to do this, then like it's 15 minutes. So I would really, if we're going to put our focus on one thing, focus on breathing. The second one is sleep, you know, getting into a good sleep pattern, sleep hygiene, you know, sleeping anywhere from 7 to 9 hours in a non-stimulating environment, making sure you're getting both REM and non-REM sleep, making, you know, waking up refreshed, waking up not feeling the need to have a coffee or not feeling the need to go back to sleep. That's kind of your next one. That's probably the most important one. That one's harder to achieve, obviously, because of life, really. So those are the two main ones. I mean, and there are some peripheral ones. Okay, so I do acupuncture. People come in for acupuncture. Not everyone has access to it. Mm-hmm. But acupuncture is a way of getting your body into a rest and digest state. Lavender oil. All of my friends, all the guys I train with think I'm nuts. But, you know, lavender oil as in a diffuser has been shown to stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system.
Okay.
So there are certain ways to do it. You know, certain types of music at a certain frequency, certain lights. There's lots of ways to get there. But to your point, what are the easy, accessible ways? And breathing is the first one.
Yeah, and I think that's so important, that even if you only start with something for 1 minute, you know, it's that 1 minute you weren't doing before. And I know personally, like when I started meditating, I started with a couple of minutes and I almost got a little addicted, and I don't really have an addictive personality. So that was interesting. And I started to feel like when I didn't do it, that I didn't feel as good. So it's interesting when you do something and maybe you don't notice the impact it's having until you stop doing it. Exactly. So I find that interesting as well, but it is accessible whether you're meditating or just breathing. And I agree with you. I think there's value in, even if you have 3 minutes spread out throughout the day, some people just never are disconnected, and to just be disconnected from technology or your phone or anything for 1 minute can, I bet you it can almost be emotional for people who realize, wow, when's the last time I actually just stopped? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. So I find when I do acupuncture, like when my office used to be downtown before the lockdown, I would do, you know, I would leave the needles in from anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour. And I realized sometimes the effect wasn't because of the acupuncture directly. It was a fact that the people on the table couldn't do anything else.
Amazing. Yeah. Interesting.
I started incorporating infrared sauna use for myself and also for patients out of my house. And that's the other thing. When you're in that room, it gets up to anywhere from 80 degrees, 140 degrees Celsius. Your phone's not in the sauna with you. So you're sitting there for anywhere from half an hour to 45 minutes, even up to an hour, in this heat, doing nothing but just sitting there.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is meditative and that component, or just, like as you said, disconnecting.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Well, we're going to wrap up soon, but I did have one more question I wanted to ask you. So I really appreciate all that insight on stress and how it impacts the physiology. And then to come back around to, I guess, more the physical side of recovery, I wanted to ask, because I thought a lot of listeners might be doing some of these things, like, what are your thoughts on rollers, like foam rollers, scrapers, and using tennis balls for, like, at home, I guess, management of muscle tension?
Like, right. So what you're doing with that, I think the rationale for these devices before were like, okay, well, so I got a massage, felt great. What how can I reproduce that at home? And by applying pressure to tissues, we're not actually changing the tissue properties with the ball, with the scraper, the scraper is going to be a bit more focal to it with the tennis ball or whatnot. What we are doing is we're increasing blood flow to the area. We're increasing inflammation by creating a certain amount of damage to the area, number one. Number two, we're modulating the sensory response. So you push on a tissue, you change the properties of it, you change how your body perceives information. So if you pinch your skin, eventually, if you don't pinch it, like if you pinch it to a point where it's a bit uncomfortable, but you keep pinching, your body stops perceiving it. So nothing's changing. You're just changing the input going into your body. And then doing that massage of the tissue definitely helps. I lean more into cupping, and there's mechanical cupping sets you can use that achieve the same thing that rolling achieves from a tissue deformation perspective. So you get the manipulation of tissues, which is beneficial. But instead of pushing the tissues down, you're pulling the tissues up. So the deformation is kind of the same, but in different directions. But where the big difference lies is when you push a tissue down, you compress those layers of, you know, the muscle, and then, you know, of the dermis, the epidermis, the subcutaneous tissue, and you squeeze normal fluid out, and you cause a bit of damaging to the tissue, so you're getting inflammation. When you cup, you pull the tissues apart, drawing blood to the area through the process of negative pressure. And that's been used for wound healing, different devices, but if you want a wound to heal quicker, you create negative pressure, drawing blood to the area. From a self-recovery or self-management, I recommend cupping rather than rolling or lacrosse ball use.
And is that something that people can do on themselves without training?
Yes and no. Not the traditional. So with traditional Chinese medicine, you use fire cups, right? So you light a fire underneath the cup, and you put the cup over top of it, and the heat draws it up.
Yeah, let's not try that at home, right?
Do not try that at home. That's my only disclaimer for this whole talk. I will say that twice. Do not try that at home.
Yeah.
The cupping sets they have, I actually ordered one yesterday for a patient, is they're literally idiot proof. You attach a suction onto them, and you suction the cup out.
Awesome.
They come in different sizes to fit on different parts of the body. Now, there are contraindications. So a lot of like traditional Chinese practitioners will use cupping to draw blood out to the ear. So what they'll do is they'll poke holes into a swollen joint so it's bleeding, and they'll cup over top of it.
Wow.
Disclaimer number two, I don't recommend doing that at home. yeah, but it's. I mean, I've had some pretty great experiences personally with them and with patients.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. So then just to summarize that, is there value then in rolling in tennis ball? Like, I personally feel the difference if I tennis ball like my glute med or whatnot or my hamstring. So is that just in my head? And I guess that's powerful too if it is in my head, but is there anything legit there?
There is. And I think that's the thing, you know, to prevent myself from being, you know, dogmatic and getting stuck in my own ways, we don't understand everything. So I'm gonna say that. Like, I don't use it a lot. If it works, it works. And that's the one thing, even if we may not understand it, we have to acknowledge that it works.
Yeah.
So it's working on some level. And if I had to, you know, theorize, it is providing a benefit from, you know, the input, the touch sensation, as mm-hmm. well as massaging the tissues.
Yeah.
So it does help from that perspective.
Okay.
From a blood flow perspective, that's where the cupping and then the rolling change. My issue and my challenge, even with the cupping, is, and I think a lot of my colleagues, including physios, massage therapists, osteopaths, would agree with me, is you want to be careful when you roll close to superficial nerves. Mm. So if a nerve is peeking out, say, you know, behind the rotator cuff or around the elbow or, you know, around the knee, again, you know, your funny bones, you don't want to roll though. You don't want to roll a nerve.
Yeah. Okay.
Worst case scenario. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we're going to wrap up here, but I just wanted to ask if you had two or three practical take homes that people could do that are very accessible as far as keeping mobile, relieving stress, or, you know, preventing recovery. What would be three, like, I guess, global, bigger picture go-tos that you tend to recommend to your clients?
So from what perspective? From a recovery perspective?
Yeah, recovery, rest, relaxation, and even just movement patterns, like functionality. If you had a couple big recommendations.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll give you more than three. Two would be things we've already talked about, you know, breathing and then the meditation. Regardless of what that meditation looks like, you know, are you doing something? Are you doing a puzzle, for example, or playing an instrument that brings you back into that state? Mm-hmm. Do something to break the stress cycle. And that's going to be different for everybody. That's number one. Number two, and this is a challenging one, is getting proper sleep, like quality and quantity. That's a deal breaker. Those are the two big ones. Mm-hmm. The third one would be fasting, to give yourself kind of a nutritional recovery day. And again, we could talk for hours just about the benefits of fasting and when is fasting too much? When is it not enough? I would recommend, and not intermittent fasting, like fasting for a good 24 hours to 36 hours from a recovery perspective. And then from a movement perspective, yeah, the general, obviously stay moving. Like, any movement's better than no movement. But if you had to, you know, if you had to say, okay, well, what type of movement? Because people are going to ask that. I would say train the muscles that tend to get lengthened and weaker, rather than stretching out the muscles that get short and tightened. And, yeah, you know, you can classify those muscles as what we call tonic or, sorry, not tonic, or dynamic or phasic muscles. And those are the muscles, say, if you're going back to your cycling, you're riding, you're hunched over, the muscles between your shoulder blades, they get over-lengthened. So you don't want to stretch it, you want to strengthen those. The rotator cuff, you want to strengthen those. You want to strengthen the hip rotators, because those are the muscles that, when we overwork something or we get injured, we're overusing something, they become dysfunctional. And when they become dysfunctional, then you start running into a whole other series of problems, whether they be injuries, poor posture, weakness. So those are the four tips: so sleeping well, breathing or meditating, fasting, training the dynamic muscles. Oh, and the last one, staying hydrated.
Yes, huge.
A lot of water.
Yeah, that's a big one for sure. Well, that's super useful. I mean, I really appreciate how holistic your view is on treatment. I mean, you're not just focused on, you know, I know there's a lot of different types of practitioners in the industry, and unfortunately, some are known for just putting out fires and wanting you to come back. But I really appreciate that you know, you want to help people change the environment. You want to get them back performing. And some people might think, oh, crazy business model. He doesn't want them back in the office. But that's exactly why I would go back to see a practitioner, is because they can get me back performing. And any elite athlete, you know, is going to at some point have injuries or just need treatment to keep them being able to function at the top level, because you're pushing yourself so close to that red line. So yeah, I appreciate that you're, you know, you look at the big picture and the stress, and why are you coming back in here so often? Like, what's causing it versus, okay, I'm just going to adjust you and hope you feel better and see you next week. I mean, that's excellent.
Thank you. Well, I've had the luxury of, you know, having worked with a lot of elite, you know, whether they're pros or Olympians. Yeah. Or, you know what, funny enough, the dance theater performers were probably the biggest learning curve for me, is that the show must go on. And to your point, if you meet someone at their level of expectation, you know, now we're talking about a little bit of business, no one has the expectation of being on your table all the time. So if you can get them doing what they need to do in order to live their lives, they'll come back when needed.
Exactly.
And, you know, I was for a short amount of time, or a couple of years, I was treating a lot of the Mervish performers here in Toronto, from mostly from the UK.
Yeah.
And they would perform 8 shows a week. And, you know, I had a bit of a, so the group of people that I worked for, the manager, they wanted us to put on, put these performers on a treatment plan. So, and you're going to come in, I want to see you Monday, Wednesday, Friday for the next 8 weeks until your show is over. And I said, I'm not going to do that, because they're not going to do that. A, they're busy doing other stuff. They're new to the city. They're rehearsing. They don't want to be on the treatment table. They want to be performing and seeing the city. So I'll treat them well enough to get them back on stage. So I did that. And then, you know, I had a lot of experience this time. And they would, and I didn't do this for that reason. They saw me all the time, because they didn't push it.
Yeah.
And so from a performance perspective, they got what they needed. They were back on stage performing, but then there was a trust. They saw me not because they wanted, they saw me because they felt it was under their control.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I wasn't trying to manipulate them. I wasn't trying to trick them, but it was human psychology 101.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I just want to ask, where can any listeners connect with you online or learn about your anatomy program, the Zona Health and Performance, and just find you on the internet?
Well, because I'm not very tech savvy, I was told to have one stopping point. If you go to Dr. Alwin Wong on Instagram, that's kind of my gateway. Everyone's on Instagram now. You can get anywhere you need to find me through Instagram at Dr. Alwin Wong. Or visit, if you're looking to book an appointment, drallenwong.com. And finally, for my online programs and courses, it's anatomyofmovementonline.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I totally value your expertise and love learning from you and having conversations with you. And we'll definitely speak again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks again, Anne.
Thank you.